So welcome to this evening to our History in the Round talk. My name is Alice. I work here as part of Christian Heritage. Well, I think most people here probably know what Christian Heritage is, but the aim is to recover the past, challenge the present, and shape the future. So sort of do that by looking at the relationship between faith and culture. And so these History in the Rounds round talks were set up as a way of exploring the relationship between faith and history in particular. So just an idea of how the evening is going to take place. So I'm going to present our speaker in a minute, but we'll have a talk for about half an hour, then some time for questions, and then we'll have time for refreshments, which I hope you can join us for. So just want to introduce our speaker, Dr. Ian Randall. So Ian has been teaching history and spirituality in colleges in London and Prague, where he's overseen research with students from Central and Eastern Europe, and then has been in Cambridge since 2008, where he's been combining theological and pastoral involvement. And he's now Research Associate of the Cambridge Centre for Christianity Worldwide. So his talk this evening is on the spiritual convictions of Martin Luther King Jr., so be, which also is meant to coincide with Black History Month, which is during the month of October. And it's sort of looking at the African-American Baptist background of Martin Luther King Jr. and its defining influence on his spiritual beliefs and those underlying his work for social justice. So so let's greet Ian.
Thank you very much, Alice. And I'm really pleased to be able to speak on the subject. I may say a bit more later about how I came to this subject originally, which was several years ago, but for the moment I'll dive straight into what I have to say. So, a quote from Martin Luther King Jr. From 1965. He said, "I am many things to many people, but in the quiet recesses of my heart, I am fundamentally a clergyman, a Baptist preacher." That was in a magazine called Ebony. And I think it's true to say that in a great deal of the literature about King, his spiritual convictions are not particularly prominent. And there have been those who have talked about him in various ways as a gifted orator or a populist politician. But only a small number really have delved in any way deeply into his Christian beliefs that really underlay, as I'm going to argue, all that he did in the area of civil rights. He belonged to, I just need to remember to put this on, I'm a Baptist preacher. He belonged to a strong Baptist family, linked to Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta in Georgia, in the USA. The family ties went back in time to the slave era. When King spoke about this, he spoke about his great-grandfather, Willis Williams, who joined the Shiloh Baptist Church in Georgia in 1846. And there's a whole story, of course, about how that slave era was connected with a new movement of spirituality. And King certainly knew from his own family history the malign power of racism. But I think it's true to say that in his early years he hadn't really worked out what kind of response he should make to this. And it was at this college, Morehouse College, an African-American Baptist college in Atlanta, that he began to really delve into what his response should be. And towards the end of his time at Morehouse, he felt that God was calling him to become a Baptist minister. It was not a theological college, it was a general liberal arts college. And he wanted, in the context of this call, to find coherent intellectual answers to the issues that were facing the American society as such a divided society, and began to look for role models within the black churches. And specifically, when he says something about this, he talks about those who combined in his mind spirituality, scholarship, and activism. And sometimes these are not the things that always belong together. In 1948, he entered Crozier Theological Seminary in Pennsylvania and began to wrestle particularly with interpretations of history, including Marxism, which, of course, was a very strong movement at the time. And he came to reject Marx's materialistic interpretation, although it's interesting that his opponents often described him as a Marxist. They wanted to write him off in these terms. I think there's one of the examples of the misinterpretation of King that has gone on. I would sum up King's position as it developed as a non-violent Christian communal approach to social action. So the communal side is very important, and we'll come back to that. And he saw this Christian community as a powerful force reaching out to an alienated enemy. I mean, we can't underestimate what the enemy wanted to do to people like Martin Luther King Jr. Again, this will come up again. And it's here that I think a really crucial idea of King's comes into play. And that is the idea of the beloved community. These two words, the beloved community, are crucial. And it is God's community. And the beloved, of course, is very much a biblical theme. The baptism of Jesus, you are my son, the beloved. And in John's gospel, particularly, the idea of the beloved. But for King, it's not just that each individual is beloved. It is a community that experiences this love of God, this relationship with God. I'm not overwhelming you so much now with my voice. So the beloved community really became central to King's thinking and has been described as his most poignant phrase. And that's just one of the short quotations. The end is redemption, the end is reconciliation. The aftermath of nonviolence is the creation of the beloved community, while the aftermath of violence is tragic bitterness. So there's a very, very strong contrast in King's mind between what he was doing, which in his mind was actually God-centered, and what was coming, although he doesn't say it so explicitly, but in a sense coming from the devil, the hatred and the bitterness and the enmity. So he speaks about these goals, redemption, reconciliation, and the creation of the beloved community. And this... essentially, the core of the beloved community was the Christian congregation. That's where the energy was going to come from. Now, the vision was becoming clearer, but I would say King could never have imagined the way in which his ministry would develop further. In 1954, he was called to become the minister of the historic Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery in Alabama. It's a church which had some commitment already to civil rights. Vernon Johns, who was an early leader of the American Civil Rights Movement, was the pastor up to 1952, 2 years before King came. And in his acceptance statement when he became the pastor at Dexter Avenue, King spoke of what he felt about his call. He said, "I come to you," this was to the church members, "I come to you with nothing special to offer. I have no pretense to being a great preacher," and of course it's ironic really that he's regarded now as one of the greatest preachers, but that wasn't his view of himself at this point. "No pretense to being a great preacher or even a profound scholar." But what he said was, and it has a prophetic ring, "I have felt with Jesus that the Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor, to heal the brokenhearted, to preach deliverance to the captives, and to set at liberty those who are bruised." And I think this is a moving way in which he began his ministry. And soon the church felt the impact of his leadership. He organized small groups within the membership with a view to stimulating more active participation of the members. And other groups were set up to administer a scholarship fund. And you can see even at this stage, that he has a vision for the members, the black members, to be empowered. So scholarship for education, and also beginnings of social and political action, and a visitation scheme for the congregation. So what I'm arguing is, although this kind of big Martin Luther King Jr. national figure is the figure that we hear about, here he is in a congregation, pastorally active. The church flourished, increased financial giving, they were able to appoint some more staff, they had a daily vacation Bible school. But then the external events begin to impinge on the life of the church. So Montgomery, the city, shaken by the public protests against racial discrimination, and King becomes involved, really, as a leader. And the very famous, of course, one-year-long Montgomery bus boycott. But I would also argue that in taking the side of Rosa King, of course, who was famously the person who wouldn't give up her seat, he was acting as a pastor. He was caring for the people who he knew. And again, the church reports that I've read speak of higher levels of spiritual development and the encouragement that the congregation was giving to each other through what was a very difficult time. The whole economic repercussion of the bus boycott was huge. And so you can see the way I'm trying to bring this argument. So the focus of the Montgomery movement and King's evident gifts that became much more apparent now. Again, I would say this is portrayed as the beginning of civil rights. But I would want to argue that many of these meetings were actually revival meetings. And even when they were out in the streets, it's got more of a sense of the spiritual than you almost ever hear about when these things are spoken about. So kneeling down in the streets and praying, this is part of what is going on. It's praying for God to move in this situation of injustice. That's what they were praying for. So revival meetings, preaching and clapping and singing and so on, and obviously prayer. And the marches were actually often at that time, and this has largely been taken out of the records, but they were often called prayer pilgrimages, these marches. And King was very, very clear that they were not to be involved in any violence, that they were to love their enemies, and he kept these biblical themes to the fore in everything that he said. He said again to the Dexter Avenue congregation that he was totally dependent on God's grace for his leadership, and when he spoke, it was shot through with biblical themes. Eventually, however, the pressures of leading a church proved too great as the national calls upon him became greater and greater, and just the pressure of the public life. And so in 1959, he resigned from his post. That's what I mentioned about Rosa Parks, yes. From his post as pastor of Dexter Avenue. But he didn't step out of pastoral ministry because of giving up that. He actually went to work alongside his father at Ebenezer Baptist Church, Atlanta. And this arrangement suited him quite well because he wasn't the one who had the number one responsibility for the church, but his desire to be involved with a local congregation, with the beloved community, as I said, was able to continue to be fulfilled. And he did bring new innovations to the church, to Ebenezer, as what we would probably call the associate pastor. And one new interesting venture was a credit union, because it was very difficult for many black people to get ordinary banking facilities. And so this was a way of promoting. And by the way, these kind of credit unions in this country, many of them came out of Christian congregations in their early days to enable people to save money and to help with financial challenges. He's also at Ebenezer set up classes in Christian doctrine. He commented, and this is something for me as a Baptist, he commented on the tragedy that the average member of a Baptist church has no conception of the doctrines of the faith. Okay. He wanted to do something about that. And so he set up these classes in Christian doctrine. Speaking at Ebenezer on one occasion, of course, there's many sermons, and I've tried to read quite a few of the published sermons. He talks in this sort of language. The word of God is upon me like fire shut up in my bones. And when you read these sermons, the sermons also record the responses of the congregation. So this is kind of one of the wonderful things about reading this. So at this point, the record of the sermon says, "Yes, that's right," which is the congregation. And then he said, "When God's word gets upon me, I've got to say it. I've got to tell it everywhere. Yes, and God has called me," and it goes on. You know, I won't rehearse all the interruptions, if you like. God has called me to deliver those who are in captivity. And I think that's a really significant thing, that for him, people in captivity, that was a holistic thing. So it was the spiritual, but it was the physical, the environmental, the everything. And that's what he wanted to see people delivered from. And we must never think, I'll probably come back to this once or twice, but we never think that he just powered on as if, you know, he was one of these invincible sort of characters. He never thought of himself in that way, and he very openly said about struggles that he had. This is just one quote to the Ebenezer congregation. He said, "I felt sin breakers dashing." So it's like, you know, waves dashing against him, "trying to conquer my soul. But I heard the voice of Jesus saying, still, fight on." And there's a lot of inner struggle when you read a lot of what he said. Now, the Birmingham, Alabama campaign and the massive march on Washington, D.C., these famous events, I would say highlighted what could be called the prophetic as well as the pastoral role. So I've, up to now, concentrated fairly on the pastoral role, because I think that's really crucial. But there is a prophetic role, and I don't know if any of you know the Plough magazine from the Bruderhof community, but I'm somewhat involved with the Bruderhof community, and they last year brought out this with articles on Martin Luther King as America's prophet. So the prophetic. During the struggle in Birmingham, the famous time when he and Ralph Abernathy were jailed and wrote from the prison on whatever bits of paper he could find. I don't know if you can quite read that, but that you just see he found a bit of paper that was something completely different, and he was even writing on toilet paper to get this letter out, the famous Birmingham letter. And it's just so spiritually shot through spiritually, this. About the dramatic scene on Calvary's Hill. Three men were crucified. We must never forget that all three were crucified for the same crime, the crime of extremism. Two were extremists for immorality and thus fell below their environment. The other, Jesus Christ, was an extremist for love and truth and goodness and therefore rose above his environment. And at the bottom, he's just saying something there. I have been so greatly disappointed with the white church and its leadership. He was really hoping that many more people from the white church would stand alongside him. And some did, but actually very few. So this was his letter from Birmingham jail, which has often been quoted, but not all of it has been quoted, I don't think. And we just have to picture him in there with the mobs outside the prison, just shouting. And we've seen it with the football match, haven't we? You know, how a mob can just... And so the words were things like, "Hang the nigger," just being shouted again and again, of course, coming into the prison. And he talks about how he had to fast for days before he could reach the point of forgiving his enemies. So it wasn't that he could just forgive right away. There was a spiritual process of fasting and prayer to come to that stage of forgiveness. I think in the prophetic as well, there's still the biblical that we see coming out again and again. The message that he brings prophetically to the nation is a message about God. And it is a message to direct people to God, not to human power. And he talks about the God of the Bible as one to whom he was directing people, the God who was a friend. And this is one of the sermons. One day, and you, at least you can see a little bit here, you ought to rise up and say, "I know him because he's a lily of the valley." Yes. "He's the bright and morning star." Yes. "He's the rose of Sharon. He's my everything. He's my mother and father. He's my sister and my brother. He's a friend to the friendless. This is the God of the universe. And if you believe in him and worship him, something will happen in your life." And in the same sermon, he said this. He said, "You may not be able to define God in philosophical terms. People have tried to do this. Plato said he was the architectonic good. Aristotle called him the unmoved mover. Hegel called him the absolute whole. There was a man called Paul Tillich who called him being itself. You don't need to know all these high-sounding terms. One day, you might know him as your friend." And that's pretty good, isn't it? And this was the sort of simplicity, really, of what he was saying. The prophetic message, in a sense, wasn't a complicated one. But it was trying to do justice to the Bible. Now, when we come to the Selma March, and probably some of you have seen the film, the Selma film, King spoke about the march and going to the promised land. And he spoke about the pharaohs of the south. So it's just inside him, this language. The people with power that he was up against were the pharaohs, were Pharaoh in Egypt. They're back there, the slaves. They're living in Egypt, and they've got the pharaohs that are against them, the pharaohs of the south. And in his historic final speech, with its words, "I've been on the mountaintop and I've seen the promised land." Again, it's just shot through with Old Testament language of Moses. And it wasn't language that he dreamed up for these big occasions. This is the language that he used in his local church ministry. So it's all connected. He spoke in one of his local church sermons. "We've got a long, long way to go. There are gigantic spiritual mountains," he said, "that we have not climbed." The same idea of going up the mountain. And I'm really wanting to say it's so reductionist to think of Martin Luther King Jr. as a black militant. And that's what he was. He was certainly trying to bring an end to injustice. He felt that very deeply. But it came directly out of his beliefs, his biblical spiritual beliefs, and his belief in Jesus. So the Old Testament was certainly very important. But when we come to the Sermon on the Mount, he was deeply influenced by this. And there's probably more said now about Gandhi as an influence on Martin Luther King Jr. than there is about what was actually the major influence, which was the Sermon on the Mount and Jesus' teaching. And he wanted to express this in very concrete ways in another famous sermon, "Loving Your Enemies." He spoke about the need for unconditional love in this struggle in which the black Christians were engaged, a struggle in which they were being clubbed, dogs were being let loose on them, they were being blasted with water cannon, ribs were being cracked, of course, there was people who were killed. So in the face of all this, you know, it's not an easy thing to say our job is to respond with love and with non-violence. But that's what he did. He said, we return to the teaching of Jesus again and again. There's a voice crying out that echoes across the generations, he said, saying, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, pray for them that despitefully use you. I just want to say something about, I've already touched on this, the sense of inner struggle. And this is what is sometimes talked about as his kitchen experience, an experience of prayer, where he said, I'm at the end of my powers. And yet, the end of his powers was a time of engagement with God. And on this particular occasion, he was receiving telephone calls, sometimes more than 40 telephone calls a day, abusing him and his family. He described this around midnight. The telephone was ringing. And he picked it up. On the other end was a voice saying, nigger, we're tired of you. If you aren't out of this town in 3 days, we're going to blow your brains out, blow up your house. And, of course, a bomb did go off in the house. And he couldn't sleep. He went to the kitchen to have some coffee. And he told the congregation that he was recounting this to, how he prayed a prayer and prayed out loud and said, I'm weak now. I'm faltering. I'm losing my courage. I don't know if people can see me like this, because they will lose their courage when they see me so weak. Then he said, it was as if I heard a voice saying, Martin Luther, stand up for righteousness, stand up for justice, stand up for truth, and lo, I will be with you even to the end of the world. He promised never to leave me, never to leave me alone. So I hope that this is a picture of Martin Luther King with Billy Graham. I hope this perhaps gives you a picture of what I think was at the very heart of what Martin Luther King was about. A desire, a call to serve God, a call to be a pastor, a call to be a prophetic person, but a call that came to a very weak human being. And one who never said that he had got it all together or that he overcame every temptation, that was never part of his life. His testimony was always, if we're doing anything, it's through the power of God. I hope that has come over in what I've said.
Thank you so much, Ian, for a really fascinating talk. Yes, it's something I didn't know anything about, so I really learnt a lot, so thank you. I just thought, we're going to open up to questions, but I thought I will use my privilege of asking the first question. I just wanted to ask, you sort of said that not many people have sort of shown an interest in his spiritual convictions, which seems sort of rather odd considering he was a minister and all that. So I'm just wondering, why has that side basically been ignored or sort of downplayed?
Yeah, I think it's part of a bigger kind of problem issue that we have today, where in much contemporary discourse, certainly in the West, not in other parts of the world, it seems very hard for people to process that religious convictions are actually liberating convictions. They're portrayed as the very opposite. And so I think, you know, either it's intentional that historians who've written want to downplay the kind of things I've talked about, or they just can't compute, you know, it doesn't work, so they've got to find something else to say. I think that's part of the reason. Of course, there are people who have brought out the kind of things that I've said, but they're not the people who are most read about Martin Luther King Jr. Yeah.
Is there any questions? Yes.
Thank you for your wonderful presentation. So actually, did Martin Luther King talk about how he went through his spiritual darkness?
Well, prayer was definitely an important thing for him. He felt this very deep personal relationship with God, but also, and this is part of the African American Christian tradition, singing was something that really lifted the spirits, so there would often be singing that, you know, when things were really hard, they would, as well as preaching, go into song. And he had several favorite hymns that helped him in these darker times. His Eye is on the Sparrow, you maybe know that. His eye is on the sparrow, and I know he watches me, etc. or He promised never to leave me, never to leave me alone. That's not so well known, perhaps, but He promised never to leave me. Precious Lord, take my hand, and at his funeral, a lot of these songs were sung. Rock of Ages, cleft for me, etc. So I think prayer and the singing was really important, and just close people around him. I was saying to a friend of mine last week that I was giving this talk. And my friend has traveled a lot, and he said, oh, I was at an airport once in the States, and the person sitting next to me as we were waiting for the plane was one of Martin Luther King's closest friends, Andrew Young. So he said, I had this whole conversation that I was able to have about Martin Luther King with one of his close friends. So I said to my friend, you should be here giving the talk instead of me. You're closer to it. But I think the close fellowship was another important thing. Yeah.
And thank you. It was great. You saw an impersonation of an African American Southern preacher. That was really good. One thing that struck me is Martin Luther King is in a long tradition. So you think of the musical heritage of the African American Southern.
Yes.
It's gospel music, it's jazz. The categories are biblical in terms of liberation. So he's steeped in all of that.
That's right.
But it just made me wonder, you're a historian, I'm putting you a bit on the spot. What's the English equivalent to a prayer pilgrimage? You can go back as far as you want. I link it to the tradition. He didn't come up with this in a vacuum. He was in this biblical liberation tradition. Mm. Where's our equivalent historically?
Yeah. Well, he was in a tradition, but I think the way that he remolded it was somewhat new. So I don't think there was the great revivalist tradition and the singing and everything, but to take that into social justice and out on the streets, I think he was doing something else with it.
Yep.
Obviously, in terms of Europe, there's a massive tradition of pilgrimage in Europe, and we've got the medievalists who can tell us a lot about that. And that is pretty powerful, actually, stuff. The pilgrimage tradition. The Reformation kind of subdued that because it saw the pilgrimages as, you know, basically going to places that they didn't think they wanted to encourage people to go to. So I think some of that pilgrimage tradition died out a bit. But obviously the revival tradition in terms of the evangelical story from the 18th century onwards is very strong. I think within Britain, but other parts of Europe as well, the sense of God's Spirit coming and, you know, powerful movements. I've looked at probably most of the revival eras, but it's not so much an emphasis on pilgrimage, but certainly outdoor meetings of large revival meetings.
And then links to social justice?
Oh, yes. Yeah, definitely. I think in terms of the story of the evangelical movement in Europe, I would probably begin with the Moravians in Central Europe in the early 18th century. And their amazing work with the slaves in the Caribbean. So the the way that they went, it was phenomenal actually what they did, just to take off, to travel to the Caribbean and to go alongside the slaves, and the whole Christian movement that came out of that in terms of liberation and of women as well as men is a massive story. But obviously also better known in this country would be Wesley and his concern for social justice and the fact that the very last letter that Wesley wrote was to Wilberforce saying, whatever the devils from hell are bringing against you, you are doing God's work for the liberation of the slaves and the end of the slave trade. And all the way through that I've seen in revivals, social justice has been really a major outcome of what has happened in people's lives. I could go on at great length, but I probably won't.
Thanks so much, Ian, for your presentation. In a sense, a related question, but we belong to a culture that talks a lot about social justice, and it seems increasingly we belong to a culture of protest now. What strikes you as you've marinated in the not just the actions, but also the language that people like King are using? What strikes you as the big? Are there any differences that strike you in the way that they talk about issues of justice as compared to our own day, which we're so desensitized to?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is just the sense of love. I mean, I think our protest movements are so often angry. The media, kind of say, well, how do you feel? And they're expecting people to be angry. If somebody said, I'm really motivated by love out of this, and I'm motivated by Jesus teaching, love your enemies and so on, they wouldn't know what to do with that. So I think that's a major thing that, cultures that, and it's not that in the past the message of love was, a widespread message. It was a radical message. It was challenging the way things were. So this is just, some of you will know this, but in the Welsh revival of the early 20th century, which was amongst many miners, the miners were very rough people. And the revival, changed individuals, but it changed the society and the workplace, in the mines and everything else. And this is a well-authenticated thing, that the pit ponies who were taking the coal from the coal face up were so used to the miners swearing at them to get them to do anything that once the revival came and the miners actually treated the ponies well, the ponies didn't know how to cope with that. So isn't that interesting? That it is a change of whole outlook, and I think that's where our protest movement today really doesn't have that very much.
Hello from a fellow Scot. I literally just stumbled upon this, and I'm so glad that I did. I actually visited...
Who are you, Dean?
I'm Dean Fine, Michelle. Are you favourite Dean? Anyway, we can talk later.
Yeah.
But I visited Atlanta in January and actually visited the burial and the museum, and I was amazed. I didn't know much that he had such a strong bond with Gandhi, and you mentioned it there, and I guess as a Christian I was a little bit, not shocked, but interested that they were really pushing that as where he got a lot of his ideas, and ideas, but I was just wondering exactly, I kind of briefed past it because I wasn't interested in it, but how much was he really actually influenced by Gandhi?
Yeah, I mean, there was definitely an influence, and Gandhi influenced other Christians as well. You know, it wasn't just Martin Luther King Jr., because what Gandhi had shown was that a passive resistance movement could have a national impact. So, you know, there was definitely a model there. But actually, I did a fair amount of work on Gandhi's early formation and discovered that Gandhi got some of his ideas about a passive resistance movement from Christians in Britain. At the beginning of the 20th century, there was quite an unusual kind of passive resistance movement amongst nonconformists, amongst Free Church people in England, who were protesting against the way in which the state church, Church of England, was so dominant. And it was about the funding that was being taken out of taxes, everybody's taxes. And so the passive resistance movement was on the part of Free Churches saying, we're not going to pay these taxes that are going to the state church. So it was a passive resistance movement. And Gandhi got quite interested in that. Of course, he took it a lot further in the Indian context. But that again is almost unknown about Gandhi, the early influence on him. Martin Luther King and, as I say, others. There was a couple of sisters in London, Christians, who were the main hosts for Gandhi when he spent 3 months in London. They were working amongst poor people in the East End of London, these two sisters, the Lester sisters, Muriel and Doris Lester. And they were pacifists in the First World War and encouraging pacifism. And then Gandhi came across. And, today people would think, it must have been the Hindus that were all behind Gandhi. But it actually was these two Christian women who took him in and hosted him for 3 months. And as we know, of course, Gandhi, greatly revered the person of Jesus. I would stick with what I argued, that the main influence was Jesus and the Sermon on the Mount. But Gandhi was definitely in the mix. Yeah.
Thank you. I love the way you brought out sort of the holistic, the way everything was sort of integrated. And so I want to ask, it's probably going to take us into some slightly trickier territory, his relationship with the white church. Mm-hmm. You mentioned his disappointment. Mm-hmm. I mean, almost what did the white church think of him? Mm-hmm. Where was their partnership and co-belligerence, particularly, I guess, among white Baptists and fellow evangelicals, where you would think there would be a more obvious common ground? What's the story, I guess?
Yeah. Well, the story is not a very happy one, really. The big Baptist denomination historically in the South was the Southern Baptist Convention, and they really came out of a bigger Baptist denomination across the whole of the USA, and their existence was because they wanted to uphold slavery, basically, and so there was a very dark shadow across that whole, white life. So the black Christians amongst the Baptists and Methodists and others, I mean, the story is fairly similar, really, of the South, where the white churches were basically white, and the black churches, produced their own denominations. And it's still... I mean, there's still a lot of that kind of segregation, obviously not in any way legal segregation, but de facto segregation. So amongst the Christians of the white churches of the South, there was a very small number that were supportive, but many, many, many who were really opposed. So his kind of base of support, such as it was from the white churches, was from the North, and he did have supporters within the white community. and obviously, you know, what I showed about Billy Graham. And he really respected Billy Graham, that Billy Graham was, you know, wanting this integrated congregation in his crusades, etc. And they, you know, they spoke very warmly of one another. And Billy did come from the South, but he had been really shaped in Chicago when he was at Wheaton College, in a very different kind of environment and outlook, and that's what he took with him. So it's taken many years, really, I think, for many of the white Christians to really come to almost repent, really, of what happened. Yes, that's right. Yes. That's right. Yeah, that is very good. That is very good. Yeah. Is that enough to?
Yes.
I mean, there's a lot of detail, but. Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's right. Of course, there's always the issue of very different styles of worship. You know, that can happen, of course, within a white community as well, or within a black community. You can get, I mean, when once or twice we've been to West Africa, and you're going to an Anglican church in, you know, a totally black African congregation, but you think, you know, I could be in Cambridge the way they're, you know, the liturgy they're doing, and there isn't, you know, the slightest idea that anybody would dance or do anything, you know, it's just whiteness in a black skin sort of thing.
Can I just ask, you mentioned that he fasted as a way of trying to, you know, forgive. Was that sort of a common response, especially as sort of persecution sort of, you know, perhaps increased or?
Yes, I mean, that seems to have been a very particular thing. So I'm not quite sure whether, you know, fasting was a kind of part of his ongoing spiritual life, but he does speak about how that particular time was so difficult. And he really had to, you know, wrestle deeply with the idea of forgiveness. Well, not the idea, the reality of it.
It wasn't a communal response. It wasn't something other people did as a group, sort of.
Oh, that's a good question. I can't be sure about that, but now that you've asked that, I suspect it probably was a group because they did work as a group. But of course, it wasn't that he was with the group when he was in prison, because he was, you know, he was isolated.
Thank you. Given the response of the white church and the white community generally, given that he was operating in the middle of the 20th century when there were lots of anti-colonial nationalist movements, and given that his rhetoric was in some senses driven by the Old Testament and by the idea of liberation and freedom, and you can think of the exodus towards the promised land, obviously.
Yes.
Is there any evidence that he was ever tempted towards a kind of separatism, like some black Americans have wanted to have their own state? And
no,
he's portrayed as the great integrationist.
Yeah.
You know, but there are some black Americans who said basically the white society is just so
completely
useless.
Oh yeah.
But we need to have our own society and our own state. Is there any evidence for that?
No, I mean, I would say it's the opposite, really, because you know, some of the great statements is, you know, let's be hand in hand, black and white, Protestant and Catholic. You know, it is really a kind of vision which, in the end, he did struggle to see whether it was, you know, coming. But that is the vision.
Okay.
Yeah, that is the vision. But interesting about the colonial side, and I didn't say this, but it maybe just fits in here. because he visited Europe, and there was actually a program about him in getting an honorary doctorate in, was it Newcastle or somewhere? It was the most unusual thing that happened. You know, one of the very few sort of things in terms of him in Britain. But he did speak after he returned to the States about the history of the British Empire as a history of exploitation. Mm-hmm. So he was prepared to address mm-hmm. the sort of colonial story. But then it's a whole, I won't go into it all, but the whole kind of sermon, he talks about that, the exploitation that has been there in the empire. But then directs people to God. He said, the power of Britain is no more, but the power of God remains. That was the sort of theme.
the other thing is, I think one just has to ask it, because there's been a lot of papers released recently about his private life being pretty messy.
Yeah.
How do you account for that, or how do you explain it?
Yeah. Well, I think what, and I have kind of revisited some of it because of what's been talked about this year. And I think the more I've looked at it, the more I've been struck by the absolute hatred that the FBI had towards him. I mean, they were obsessively hatred, bitter, and despised him in every way. And so I think they were, they were not above any kind of scheme to discredit him. Yeah, I do. Yeah, and I think some of the recent stuff is actually pointing in that direction. Although it seems to be pointing to, you know, some worse conduct on his part, I think it's actually pointing to the FBI and what they were creating. I mean, there was one tape which was sent to his family of an alleged sexual encounter that he was having, and it was being taped. They were taping everything, the FBI. Wherever he went in a hotel, they had their bugs in the hotel, etc. So they, you know, they were obsessive. But this particular tape that was sent to him, I think, might well have been. You know, I'm not saying he didn't ever fail sexually. But it's interesting that that was the one, and it went to his family and everything else. And it went with a note from the FBI saying, now, nigger, you should commit suicide because we've exposed you. So that was the level of the what they were, you know, into, the FBI. So I'm very cautious about what's coming, you know, what is supposedly the evidence from the FBI, because I think they were quite prepared to do anything in terms of lies or make up things, and even construct things with his voice, which wasn't even him. So that's where I am at the moment on that. Hindu.
He comes across in portrayals of him as a scholar. Mm-hmm. What were his scholarly interests?
Well, he wanted to be a scholar. I don't think he ever had time to be a scholar, actually. Yes, that phenomenon is known. Yes. So he did. I mean, he did pursue philosophical studies. He was, you know, he was interested in philosophy. But you can see in the preaching that, you know, he's read the philosophers, but he doesn't really want the sermons to lead people to philosophy. He knows what he's talking about, but that's not where his heart is. But he wanted well-educated preachers. He didn't want people who were know-nothings, because that also played into the hands of the enemies of the black churches.
Ask again. I love the sermons that were recorded with the congregation's responses. I was just wondering, were they published like that at the time? And if so, what was the intended audience? Sort of, you know, as in it's quite interesting actually including those responses. So was there a reason for actually publishing them in that way?
Well, I think it would have seemed odd if they weren't, you know, because people would have said, well, where's the congregation? You know, because we all know that that is what was happening. So when we talk about audience, I'm sure it was much more read amongst the black community than amongst the white community. And I think it was just one of these, you know, very natural things that somebody, I mean, some of them might have been taped, I think, and therefore the, you know, the responses would have been there anyway. But also stenographers would have just recorded everything. And I love that, actually, because, you know, often I've done a bit on the history of preaching. And often in the in when people do stuff on the history of preaching, the congregation disappears. It's, you know, it's the preacher who is there, and the congregation are sort of invisible. But what's preaching without a congregation? It's nothing. So, you know, I just love that. When I've given, I should have said that I got interested in doing some. What was at the time, I think, fairly major research on Martin Luther King 10 years ago. It's when we lived in Prague. And I discovered when we lived in and traveled a lot in Eastern Europe that in the communist times, Martin Luther King was a great hero to the communists. But they completely wrote out his Christian side, of course. But he was against America, in a sense, you know, against the white powers of America. So the communists saw him as a kind of ally. So he was very popular. And I got the opportunity because of doing research. This was 40 years on from his death. So we've just had the last year, the 50 years. But this was 40 years. I got the opportunity to speak to, you know, some audiences where, and this is encouraging to historians, if I had just been going in as a kind of Christian communicator, I wouldn't have been able to, but they were interested in the history of him, and of course then I brought in, you know, the stuff that I wanted to bring in. So that's how it came about. But in other times, so that was, you know, in a secular audience, you've got to do it in a certain way. But sometimes when I've done it with audiences of Christians, I've got them to do the responses. So, you know, I've put the stuff up on the screen, and you get it all going, which I love anyway. We were at on Sunday evening, Janice and I, we're members of Histon Baptist Church. We live in Histon. But on Sunday evening, we were at Holy Trinity Church here, and there was an African Rwandan preacher, and he was a wonderful, you know, really in this black tradition of preaching. But even though it's quite a, you know, a fairly lively church, we were all sitting there, you know, completely kind of no response whatsoever to all this amazing preaching that was going on. I'm sure in the heart there was a response. But if it had been a black congregation, it would have been very different.
Great. Well, I think we'll end there. But as I mentioned at the start, we've got refreshments afterwards. So if you want to continue discussion off the back of this talk. And just to say, so the talk this evening is part of a series of talk called History in the Round, looking at the relationship between faith and history. So our next one is on Wednesday, 13th of November at 7 p.m. And it's Dr. Robert Evans, he'll be a talk on deciphering the round church, so actually unpacking a bit the myths about this building and, yes, sort of teaching us about all the meanings behind it. So that's our next one. But, yes, just wanted to thank you, Ian, again, for an amazing talk. So.